Peter Langston is a writer, a poet, and a cricket obsessive who often appears on ABC Radio over summer to talk about the sport that he adores. But today isn't about cricket. Peter lives with bipolar disorder, which is not uncommon among writers. He's learned how to manage the highs and the lows that cycle through his life, but it took a long, long time for that to happen. As a young man, Peter would ride a high for many months of frantic activity and sleeplessness, followed by the most horrible, catastrophic lows. And this was at a time when these things weren't hugely well understood. Peter was a country teacher for years and found that he could use this manic energy to work long, productive hours. But one day, in a meeting, someone said something that triggered a flash of memory. A memory of an incident from his childhood. And this blindsided him, and he collapsed to the ground. And a fuller picture of that incident from his childhood only came to him in fragments in the following months. Peter is here to tell a story of some very dark episodes in his life that some people will find distressing, and it's not suitable for children. But it's also a story about memory, about living with things that can't be undone, and ultimately, for Peter, it's about freedom. Hello, Peter.
Thanks, Richard. Yes.
You grew up in the Sutherland Shire. I did too for parts of my childhood. And what happened when you were identified at school as being a clever kid?
Well, I think mum and dad were a little concerned at first. They'd never had one of them. I was identified for the OC class at the end of year four, or fourth class, as we called it then.
This is the opportunity class for bright kids,
That's right, yeah. And their decision was that they would rather see me stay in mainstream school. They were concerned that once I hit high school that, you know, I might have grown an extra ear or something, but they were concerned that it would change me significantly and I wouldn't fit in. As it turned out, I was a nerd anyway, so it didn't make any difference.
How did you feel about missing out on that? Did you agree with that decision?
I was upset at first because even though they weren't telling us as students a lot about what the thing was, it was fairly clear that those that were going off to the class were, you know, the kids that we considered to be bright, and to be included in that bunch was a little bit of a surprise to me. So,
were you at school with the nerdy kids then, or with the sporty kids?
I was in both as we went through high school. The way it worked out, I was very much the nerdy kid in terms of how I went through school. Was difficult. I found it quite easy. I enjoyed the work. Always got the marks I needed, etc. So in that essence, I was a nerd. But then when testosterone kicked in at 13 or so, and I started scoring tries and kicking goals and being able to hit a cricket ball quite well, suddenly I was in with the sporty mob as well. So I was sort of on loan to the sports people. And then once the game was over, it was back with the nerds.
Did that stop you from getting your head beaten in as punishment for being good at your schoolwork?
It did, actually. It was quite a handy thing. I didn't really get attacked that much. And also, I was very clever. I made sure that my three best friends were all huge.
Were you a happy kid as a little boy before adolescence?
Yeah, very happy. I mean, I'd describe myself as, and my parents would have, everyone, I was just one of those sort of smiles on the face all the time, happy, just enjoying life.
Did that change much when you became an adolescent?
Well, yeah, it did. For a period of a couple of years there, things became quite difficult. And of course, then as bipolar started to appear around about 14, 15, then I sort of tended to have a lot more confidence, and all those things that what used to worry me about other people, I didn't seem to care that too much about. However, yeah, I did have moments when things got pretty bad.
There was a moment when you were 16 years old, absolutely appalling. Well, appalling's the word for it, but a terrifying thing happened to you. Tell me what happened that day when you found yourself on an overpass.
Yes, well, it was probably the first depressive episode that I had experienced. I was very confused, and I, at the time, had no idea why I was confused. And I just had this overpowering desire to get rid of that confusion. I couldn't seem to blot it out. Something was concerning me that I couldn't get rid of. And so I took myself up onto an overpass at Miranda Fair, where the traffic went underneath a car park type arrangement.
This is the shopping centre in Miranda in Sydney?
That's correct, yeah. And I stood there on the outside of at that stage, of course, there weren't all the guardrails you have now. And so I I simply remember standing there and looking and waiting for the biggest truck. Yeah, wanting very much to jump off into the line of traffic.
To kill yourself?
Yes, yeah.
What stopped you from doing that?
Well, a little old lady, I'm afraid. I wish it had been heroic and been a big bloke who'd pulled me over the rail, but this lady came over and said, "You're going to fall if you're not careful," and touched me on the hand, and it was just the human touch, I think, was what made the difference.
You said that you were sort of troubled by this powerful sense of confusion. Was it a very oppressive sense of confusion that you just had to escape?
Yeah, it was like something that I knew that no one else did and that I couldn't tell.
Was there a shape to it?
No, not really. I don't think so. Just, I suppose also as part of anxiety, which I went on to suffer, suffered as an adult, you know, heaviness and fast breathing and those heaviness of the chest and, yeah.
Where were you taken once you stepped back from the brink?
Well, the lady that told me to get back over had also got some security guys, and you know, security guys at Miranda Fair are very different than they are nowadays. This was a fellow with, I can still remember one of those older guys where his belt starts out on his back at one height and ends at a much lower height underneath his stomach, and he sort of said, "Come on, son," and a doctor was called. I don't know who the doctor was, but the doctor was called, and I ended up at Sutherland Hospital, and mum and dad were called up there too.
Was this when, the mid-1970s, thereabouts?
Yeah, early 70s.
Early 70s. What happened when you were taken to hospital?
Well, I was taken up there and everyone came and had a chat with me. But what I got to know as a psychiatrist who I saw over about the next 6 to 8 weeks in weekly visits, and he wanted to talk about why I was there and what was making me feel bad, and he ended up with the conclusion it was all mum and dad's fault, so I didn't want to argue with it. It seemed an easy way out for me.
What was all mum and dad's fault?
The fact that I ended up on that bridge, yeah.
That you were ready to kill yourself?
Yeah, the fear. His idea was that it was some deficiency in their parenting, which was obviously rubbish, but once I realised that I had to get out of this situation, this weekly visits, I had to take myself up to the library at Sutherland and I looked up psychology books, and I found something that looked, I can't remember what it was now, but something that looked like a lesser of all the evils I could possibly have, and then started to feed him information about it. So he drew the conclusion that's what was wrong with me.
So you were contriving to get the diagnosis that would be easily just dealt with and put aside as quickly as possible?
Yes, we could, you know, just sort of say, well, this is a thing, it's happened, it's all right, don't worry about it. But it's basically, mum and dad, if you'd done this differently, that would have changed things. So
you were, so you, after enduring that, you're reading all this psychology in the library to feed something that the psychologist can use and create a diagnosis with.
Yeah, you know, I wanted it all to get away, Richard. I didn't want it to be something that was going to be ongoing in my life.
How was the treatment then resolved? How did all that come to an end once the diagnosis had been made?
We had a massive meeting. There must have been 25 people in the room, including mum and dad and myself, and everyone had a few words to say. And then it was decided that I was safe to go home. So,
did your parents treat you any differently after that?
Mum probably fussed a bit more. She always did. I've been accused in the family as being mum's favourite. I, of course, always denied it while enjoying the favouritism. and I think she probably spent a lot more time with me, and I've got very fond memories of that time. Dad wasn't a workaholic, but he had to work very long hours to feed and clothe 5 kids.
They must have been so shocked and bewildered by, first of all, you trying to do that, and then the doctor's diagnosis of that.
Yeah, it was rather difficult, the whole thing, I think. And it's one of the things that I think has been made it very difficult later in life for my dad to come to terms with me being bipolar, etc. Although in some ways it should explain a lot of things, but it's taken him a while before he could accept it. And now it's great. Now we can relate very well about it. So.
Yeah, a lot of disorders were blamed on the parents back in those days.
Yeah.
Like Asperger's was the frigid mother, that was blamed on the parents, wasn't it, back in those days? All these things aren't true, as it turns out.
No, well, in fact, in some ways it was mum's fault, because genetically I've probably got bipolar from her. So
it is in the family.
Yeah, it is.
So after that, how did the rest of your school years go then?
Look, fabulously well. I did well at sport. I was in, you know, top 10 at the HSC. Everything was going very well until I went off to university and then I crashed again. So,
did you think much about that day afterwards or did you just want to put it out of your mind?
It's gone. It's finished.
You love cricket, like I said. How serious were your sporting ambitions back then, Peter?
Well, every September, Richard, I still hit a ball on a string and send my capsize to Cricket Australia just in case. I'm starting to lose a little bit of faith that it's going to happen, but I was very serious. I was playing rep cricket. I came to it late, but I was playing rep cricket about 18, 19 for Sutherland Shire. Had a couple of great games in the great competition and then went to Armidale after that. But I was extremely serious and I really believed I could make it until the day that I faced Andy Roberts in the nets at Caringbah Oval, and off two paces he bowled three balls to me, one hit off stump, the next hit leg stump and the third hit middle stump. But I'm very proud of the fact that I got an inside edge to the one that hit middle stump. I knew at that stage I was not going to play Test cricket.
Oh man, was that painful? That must have been horrible.
It was in a way, but I went on to love the game so much that it didn't make that much difference.
Was it a hard dream to put aside?
It was, because there were people around me who went on to play much higher levels that I considered myself to be in their league at that time. But yeah,
I suppose one of the, I don't know if you call it a plus, but I suppose it is a plus of one of the aspect, or anyway, of bipolar disorder, is you do become a great enthusiast for other things, though, don't you?
Fairly quickly, yes.
Pretty quickly, and then very intensely.
Bright shiny things, you know, they come past your eye line, and away you go.
Gimme, jump on it. That's it. Why did you want to become a teacher?
I had this. My sister was a teacher. She's still my hero, and I really wanted to do what she could do. And we had a period of time where my brother and I stayed with my sister while Mum and Dad were on a holiday, and I sat in on several of her classes, just while I had work to do that was set by my own school. But I sat in on some of her English classes, and she taught like I'd never been taught that way. She was larger than life and did all these amazing things, dressed in costume and did voices for the kids and brought Shakespeare to life like no one I'd ever seen do before. And I thought, well, I'd love to do that. I'd love to follow my sister into that profession.
What are the long-term pleasures of being a teacher as you see kids change over time?
Look, I can define it to that single aha moment where a child you've been working with for some period of time and they suddenly get it. Doesn't matter what the thing is that you're going through, that they suddenly get it. And that aha moment is worth all the pay, all everything else. It's what it adds up to know that you make, somewhere in there you made a difference.
So you decided to become a teacher, went off to study. What went wrong with your first crack at studying to become a teacher, Peter?
Well, what went wrong was too good a time, really. I hit Armidale, and I very much enjoyed the company and hospitality of the local hotels, and I basically was enjoying several other things as well. And it escaped me that I needed to actually hand assignments in. I did attend, always attended lectures, regardless of what state I was in, but. And then an older lecturer pulled me aside after about 6 weeks and said, I've had a word to a few of your fellow lecturers and you're going to be kicked out of here at the end of first semester unless you start handing in some assignments and getting serious. And the guy reminded me so much of my dad that I felt like I'd been given one of those talks that Dad's famous for. I suppose all dads are famous for. And so I said, well, I'm going to do it. You know that assignment that's due this afternoon, sir? Well, can I have till Monday? I'll hand it in. He said, no, you hand in this afternoon.
This afternoon?
Yes, yeah, right. So I did. And in one of those flashes of bipolar things that happen when one just puts their head down and does things. And that's really what probably saved what was happening, because I was really enjoying myself far too much.
What was your state of mind? How changeable was it in this time?
Basically manic. I was on a constant roll and high. The nature of my bipolar, as I know it now, is that when I'm manic, I can stay that way for lengthy periods of time. Depressive states tend to be shorter, but far more deep and dramatic. But the mania will roll along for sometimes weeks and weeks and weeks.
How are you when you're manic, when you're in the up period of that?
I am impossible. I know everything. I'm actually funny, but which doesn't happen except then. I'm bulletproof. You know, it's the normal thing. 10 feet high. Don't sleep. I think my record for not sleeping is 10 days, but regularly when I'm manic, it's, you know, no more than 2 to 3 hours.
You're like the guy at the party who's taken a ton of cocaine, in other words.
Yeah.
It's like, like that the hyperactivity.
Yep.
You can talk and
fast,
be the centre of attention at a party, that
always,
kind of thing.
Yeah, talk very, very fast, think very fast, solve problems very quickly. Yeah, it's like being on cocaine, only my nose still works.
And confidence levels.
High, very high. Except even at my best, I was always scared of women. Always terrified. Women scared me and terrified me something. Still do to a large degree.
When you're in that manic phase at that time, was that seen as arrogance?
I think it probably was by a lot of people, and my friends not so much, because when you are high like that, your friends, you're a good person to have around, because you can have a good time vicariously off the person who's sort of slowly destroying himself. But, yeah, no, I was certainly arrogant, and I can still be accused of being arrogant too.
How are you getting by with sleep? The absence of sleep, I should say.
It never worried me. I would regularly not sleep, especially if I had an assignment due. My typical response to doing an assignment was that I would get all the books out of the library 3 weeks before it was due. I'd leave them piled on the desk until 3 days before it was due. Then I would read them from cover to cover, and I would sit down in one draft, write the assignment, you know, 3,500, 4,000 words, bang. And invariably, I would always get good marks for it. And the only time at college I failed an assignment was when I put three or four weeks of drafting into it.
Oh, you overwrote that,
did you? I overwrote it. I destroyed it.
How about the downs? How long would they last?
As I say, not long, but dramatically deep. And they got gradually worse, actually post-college when I was teaching.
And when you were going through those downs, would you then be paralysed? Was it one of those downs where you just couldn't get out of bed, or was it something else?
No. Well, as the downs got worse, and that happened over time, I got to the point of having dissociative episodes, and where I would lose 3 or 4 hours, and I might just sit in the middle of a football oval or something and not move. But generally speaking, when I'm down, I found it very difficult to function, but I still did function, particularly when I was teaching, because I still had to turn up and do the job. Although, I guess fairly regularly, probably 3 or 4 days a term, I would take a sick day when it was really that I was depressed.
What about voices?
Yeah, voices were there, yeah. But the voices are a strange thing for me to talk about. There was a voice that was with me from the time I was about 11 or 12, and I always used to just sort of say it was my conscience or that inner being that was talking to me. And then right through, it seemed the best ideas I had came from that one voice. But as time went on, the voices extrapolated out to, in the end, before I broke down, I had 5, and none of them were good. So
none of them were good. So that first voice you had, the one that was giving you good stuff,
yeah,
that changed then.
She changed. They were all female, yeah. The guy's got a problem with women, I can tell you. Yeah, she changed. She became very nasty and always tearing me apart. And everything I would try and do that was in the right direction, she would say was wrong. There was another voice who I nicknamed Sister Jack, after the character in Father Ted.
Well, like Father Jack, right, Father, but she was Sister Jack.
Sister Jack, yeah. She would just swear nonstop. That's the only thing I'd ever hear from her, just this foul language. And usually it was fixated on one word, just over and over and over and over.
And when would these voices make themselves manifest? When would they appear?
The last 10 years before I was diagnosed. Every day, every time I opened my eyes, they were there
all the time.
All 5.
All
yeah.
the time.
All the time.
And they were instructing you.
Yeah, one was it, there was another that was, as the more my wife tried to help in the situation, there was another voice that was suggesting I should kill her.
Kill your wife?
Yeah. So, and there was another voice that just cried all the time. Just that's all I heard from, just these sobbing and crying. So,
were they overwhelming at times?
At times, but not often. It was sort of, it sounds very strange to try and understand, but they became like companions, so that when we eventually got rid of them, there was a period of time I went through, I was kind of lonely for them because they weren't there anymore, because I'd lived with them for, I don't know, 25, 30 years or something, or well, all five of them for 10 years. So,
you mentioned you got married. How did you meet your wife, Sue?
I met Sue in a wine bar. A mate of mine was playing, and he invited me to get up and do a couple of songs, and she had just walked in with some friends of hers. They'd just finished their trial HSC, and they were very happy, we'll put it that way. And she sat down beside me, and I'd just broken out of a relationship and had decided no more women. I'm getting through college. I'm going to be a teacher. I'm not getting involved in relationships.
What is it with that? When you say that,
you're in trouble.
That's when I don't know. You know, there's a theory you should open yourself to love and say I'm ready for it. But no, it's the opposite. When you say that's it, that's when the girl of your dreams walks into your life.
Never going to happen. Anyway, yeah. She sat down and she said, "You've got a lovely voice. I should know because my brother's got a big music collection." Well, I found out later we had three albums, and you know, one of those was Chicago. So.
That's a good pickup line, though. You've got a lovely voice. It's nice.
It is. It's a very, very good pickup line. So I invited her out to go and have dinner with me the next night. She gave me a fictitious address. I found her anyway. She gave me the street. It was right, at least. So there I am. And at that stage, I'd had a motorbike accident, so I'm on crutches. And I'm going from house to house, knocking on doors in the dark in Armidale, saying, "Excuse me, do you have a young daughter who's..." You can imagine how well that went over. But I eventually found her, and I was actually at college with her sister, and we went out for dinner, and then I think a drive-in on the third night, in which case she said I was moving too fast. But on the sixth night, it was the day that Elvis died.
1977.
Yeah, and double celebration for me because I didn't like Elvis. I asked her, "I'm thinking of getting married," and she said, "Who to?" And that was that. And everyone says that I was crazy because I asked her to marry me after 6 days, but she said yes in the same time. So,
and you're still married today?
35 years.
You'd been drinking quite a bit up until that period, hadn't you?
Yes, I had.
Was it to deal with the kind of voices and the stress and everything else?
Just good time. Yeah. Just, I think it was just the highs more than the lows. And she was very worried about it because at this stage I was drinking two bottles of scotch a week. And as well as other things. So I went to a doctor and he told me I was in the early stages of alcoholism. I think that was just based on quantity. And I just stopped basically from then, and I didn't drink for another 3 or 4 years after that.
So you got your first proper teaching job. You were sent out bush to a town called Nowandock?
Nowandock.
Nowandock. I just knew I'd get that wrong. Nowandock. What's your memory of the school like?
The school was lovely. There was a wonderful principal by the name of Dorothy Cortenbar, and she was a lovely lady. It was a four-teacher school. The fourth teacher actually supervised correspondence students and taught secondary students and taught maths. But it was a very, very small number of kids. But I guess the strongest memory is a great little farmhouse that we lived in. It was right down the bottom of a hill in a narrow little valley that you get where you have these coastal valleys that are fairly, you know, you've got a valley very close to your tablelands dropping off into you. And it was a bush-built house, you know, none of the doors would shut properly and there were big gaps at the tops and the bottoms and everything else. And we had an agreement that when one of us got a teaching job, then we would start a family. Now, I'm not quite sure how that was going to work if it was Sue, but anyway, I think she figured I'd get the teaching job. So I think it was a week or 2 weeks after I started work, she just greeted me one night with saying, I've just thrown the pill in the toilet. And I thought, I wonder why she did that.
So how long? So then you became a dad.
I did, yeah. Our oldest, Chris, he was born after we moved there and went to a school called Barmbar.
How were you managing psychologically at that stage?
Well, at Barmbar I became, that would have been a principal now, but teacher in charge at that stage. And look, towards the end of that time, I must admit my teaching was pretty ordinary. I wasn't coping with all the pressure from parents and P&C meetings and various other things. And I used to take the kids out in the playground and make up maths games and science games that somehow looked a lot like playing a game of cricket. And so that was basically, you know, I probably ruined the education of a number of children out that way. And then Sarah came along at the end of the second year there, and I by that stage was getting pretty fragile.
sort of life pressures were you feeling when you went back to Armidale to teach there? How were you managing by then?
Well, I was basically by the time I got back to Armidale, I was in a middle. I was really down, bad depressive state, very bad depressive state, and I just couldn't cope with going to work. So anxiety attacks hit for the probably first recognisable time then. So that every morning I'd try and get myself off to work, and I'd get as far as the car park, and I'd have pains in the chest, and you know, all classic anxiety, and I'd throw up, and I'd get in the car and go back home.
And so you wouldn't even get through the door?
No, I couldn't get through the door. You know, I just didn't. I think on the basis of the avoidance that I was doing at my last job, I just didn't think I could teach anymore. That went on for about 6 weeks. Ran out of pay, ran out of sick leave. Had to go back to work. We had to feed the kids. And so essentially I just forced myself back to work. And luckily the boss I had there was open to me being honest about the situation. And she used to meet me in the car park with a banana because it would calm my stomach. A lovely lady.
So she was really supportive then?
Incredibly supportive. And yet she was known as a real dragon lady. And yet to me she was wonderful.
Why do you think she was so supportive of you?
Well, she was probably just a class act. Perhaps she'd experienced that with her own. I know members of her own family were teachers. Maybe that was the reason. I don't know really, but it was a wonderful act that saved my teaching career actually.
How then did the cycle swing back up again after that? Did you stay there for very long? Did things pick up for you after that?
Yeah, I was 6 years in that school. But at the early stages, the hard part was that I was going through the development of what became a pattern that would occur with me where I'd have these rapid cycles. So I could be desperately down on a Friday and then I'd go out and play cricket and I'd feel fantastic. In fact, I scored my first career century in those first few weeks back in Armidale. And then I'd crash again on the Monday and the Tuesday.
Previously you'd had these really long cycles then, months and months and months for being up, then bad, shorter but bad, profound, low. So this started then spinning around much quicker.
Yeah, so according to the psychiatrist at least, that's where they identify that the rapid cycling started that went on to become ultra-rapid cycling, which is like four seasons in a day.
What sense were you able to make of that, if any, at the time of what you were?
Don't think I could. Look, at that stage, I was trying desperately to raise two little kids and then a third one not long after. We needed to have food on the table. My wife was becoming desperately unhappy because she didn't know what was going on with me. I eventually threw myself in and got involved in sporting clubs, particularly in cricket clubs, and that then started to take up a large part of my time. So that I didn't feel as fixated on work because I had other things to do. Got involved in community radio and did a few other things and started writing, which I hadn't for a while. So
you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online and on digital radio.
Peter Langston is my guest. Peter is a writer and a poet who lives with bipolar disorder. He was a teacher for many years. And just a reminder, some parts of Peter's story are distressing. Peter, these mood cycles between super productive, manic highs and terrible lows were accelerating. You were transferred to another small school in Tambo. How did that work out for you?
I get it right because they get upset out there if you don't say it right. Tambar Springs.
Tambar.
Tambar Springs,
okay,
yes.
I beg your pardon.
Tambar was a difficult school. And I suppose in many ways I was the perfect person to put there because someone who could think fast, act fast, get millions of things done, work long hours, then I was a person who could get lots of things happening there. And we did, and for the first 3, 4, or 5 years, I suppose, we got masses and changes to the school and lots of things I'm very proud of and teaching awards and all sorts of things, which were great. We had kids who wanted to write, kids who were reading, and in particular, kids who wanted to write, so with daily journaling and those sorts of things that they'd never seen or done before. It was a position I loved, but clearly my mental health was starting to fail after about 5 years.
1994, the local minister came to the school to talk with you about helping kids at the school who are at risk. Tell me what happened that day.
Well, it was a meeting we used to have reasonably regularly and often used to include the local policeman, where we'd talk about kids that we were concerned about, and we talked through some kids we thought might be getting beaten and various other things. And the minister said to me, well, I think I'm concerned that there might be sexual abuse going on with, you know, this child. And at that instant, and the only way I can explain it is exactly how it appeared to me, it was as though someone had rolled down a video screen in front of me. I knew where I was still in the same place, I knew Marcus was still with me, but suddenly I was getting a replay of something that happened, and I was the feature of what was going on. So, and in that, I was back in a toilet in Miranda Fair, in the shopping centre, and someone had come in and grabbed me over my shoulder and was holding me and bending me over and pushing my face down into a toilet. And then I felt this tremendous sharp pain between my buttocks. Now, I know I was 11. I knew nothing of what sex was. I actually thought he was stabbing me. I thought I was going to die because he was stabbing me. And right up until some time later, I still thought that's what had happened. I struggled to get free, and as I did get free, he said, If you ever tell anyone that I've done this, I'll come to your house and I'll cut your throat and I'll cut your sister's throats and I'll do the same thing to them. And I came outside to find my mum, who was waiting out there. She told me sometime before she died it was probably the first time she'd ever let me go into a toilet by myself. And, yeah, the rest, that was all I got in that first flash, that first recall.
And when you were getting that flash, was this all happening through your own eyes, or were you standing outside of yourself, watching yourself?
It was both, and that was the thing that when I look back on it, still disturbs me. I was both watching it happen, and in it was like sort of split screen in a way. You know, I was being both people, an observer and the participant.
So this awful, shocking thing is happening before your eyes while you've been there talking to the minister in the school. What was happening? What did the minister see you doing while this was happening?
He saw me fall down on the ground and basically go into a fetal position, white as a sheet, and he said, I just kept saying no, over and over and over. He believes I was in that state for probably a minute, maybe a little less. It's a bit hard, if you've ever been through just seeing someone who's, it's like when someone's bleeding, you think they've lost a lot more blood than they actually have, and when someone's having a fit, it appears to go on forever. But he thinks about a minute. I can't tell you because I wasn't able to gauge. I just came to, and I know I felt faint. I felt sick. The one thing I did know was that what I'd seen was real, that it had happened, that it was real. After I recovered, he suggested that I really needed to go off and see someone and that I needed to deal with it.
And did you?
Oh, no, of course, no. Several days in my manic state again, my robust state, I thought, no, I can deal with anything. I can deal with this. That's nothing.
So you just pushed it to one side then?
Yes, absolutely. Why should I worry about it, Richard? Gee, that was... Yeah, that's what I did. I tried to pretend it didn't happen, but I just was convinced that I could manage it.
So you had that fragment of memory. Did more fragments
Yes.
come to you after that?
Over the course of the next 8 years, initially I got several at once. Within the next month, I got lots.
And would it have the same effect? Would it kind of blindside you? And
some were during the day. Others came as part of dreams. But most of the ones that pieced the story together were during the day, and yes, the same sort of thing would happen. Most of the things that happened at night were often extrapolating from what I'd remembered, and I'd have the most horrific dreams, which would, you know, this would be me being attacked, but then it escalated to my kids being attacked, to me standing in a corner not doing anything while that was happening, and all the time just blood, just bright red blood everywhere, just blood.
As these fragments came back to you, what do you remember your 11-year-old self doing after this assault, after you'd been raped?
Yeah. One of the hardest memories to get back was the fact that I came out of the toilet with my pants down, and my mother said, pull your pants up, you dirty little boy. Now, she didn't mean it in the context of what had happened, obviously, but That was a big imprint.
Like you'd done something wrong.
Yeah.
She didn't mean it like that.
No, she couldn't possibly have meant it like that.
But that's how you... Do you think that's how you took
it? My mum was a terrier. If she'd known what had gone on, he'd be dead now. Earlier. And then afterwards, I took myself off to the incinerator at the school that was next door to us, and I burnt my pants and my undies.
Why? Because they had blood.
Blood everywhere, yeah. The next day, it was still bad, so I took myself off to the doctor, our family doctor.
What, on your own, without telling your parents?
Yeah. I stole some money from mum's purse so I could pay for the appointment, and took myself off, and he stitched me up and... wanted to give me a talk on sex education. Remember, I still didn't know what was sex. It didn't mean anything to me.
You were 11?
11, yeah. But he asked me if older boys were wanting to have sex with me, and that meant nothing to me. So, and then I begged him not to tell mum and dad because I was frightened that if they found out, this guy would come and kill us all, sort of thing. And it was a promise he kept. I wish he hadn't. I really wish he'd told them, but he apparently kept it. Again, psychologically, according to the psychologists and psychiatrists I've worked with, I gradually started to push that down, pushed into an area where I couldn't access it, and that they believe that's the reason why bipolar surfaced quicker in me, because normally it arrives around late teens, early 20s, but often if there's a trauma, it will come earlier. And
so just to be clear, you think bipolar disorder was just latently there along?
Yeah.
And this was an incident that it didn't create the disorder, it triggered it.
That's correct,
it's manifested.
And that's quite typical, and you'll find that in most of the research materials and stuff. So there's a high prevalence of bipolar in my family and subsequently in my own family too.
The man who did this, did you know who he was?
It took, as I said, 8 years. That was the last thing I remembered. I always used to just call him Hairy Arms because he had these hairy arms. I actually did see him. I know now I did see him, but I had blocked it. But I did eventually remember who he was.
He was known to you and your family?
He was so known to our family that in one of the later flashbacks that came to me came the memory of him, and I don't know at what time after the attack, visiting our house for dinner. And sitting across from me, and while others were distracted, picking up his knife and running it across his throat while I watched, just to remind me of his promise.
I have to ask the question, how certain are you that this is all, particularly that later memory, is real or it's not some extrapolation from a nightmare?
Yeah, good question. Using the rule of thumb that the things that I seem to remember that made sense were things that I remembered from a conscious state as opposed to an unconscious state, and that was the way it's been explained to me by people with more knowledge of these things than I have.
As these flashbacks were coming back to you over the years, how much did you tell Sue, your wife, of what was happening?
I didn't tell her a lot early, but then I sort of had to start telling her things because of what was happening at home and because of, I would wake up from the dream screaming. Mostly I would have wet the bed, sometimes worse. You can't really hide that from your wife. So, she ended up knowing all of it.
You mentioned you had some dissociative episodes. These are episodes where you just blank out for a while and disappear. Where would you go typically?
Well, the longest one, I sat in the middle of the school oval from about 11 o'clock at night till about 3 o'clock in the morning. And my wife came down, discovered me there, realising that she understood, but at that stage she knew what a dissociation was and just sat near me and watched. And at some point I just got up and took myself off to bed and woke up in the morning and wondered why I still had my shoes on and there was mud through the bed and all that sort of stuff.
So all this time you're trying to bring up a family and hold down a job, you're already managing bipolar disorder and then there's this other thing.
That's the problem. I wasn't managing bipolar disorder because I didn't know I had it.
You were,
I was living with it.
Living with something rather than managing it. Struggling to even really understand what it was all about. It sounds like you were heading towards a breakdown.
Mm. And that's eventually what happened. I'm very proud of the fact that I don't believe any of these behaviours ever impacted on kids that I taught. Maybe that's just luck, or maybe there was some sense of control to make sure that didn't happen. I don't know, but it never actually impacted on kids. And when I did eventually break down, I got rushed into hospital with what they thought was a heart attack, and basically it was, you know, I just broke down completely.
What, you like the chest pains, and did you think you were dying?
Yes, I did. The chest pain was very real, but nothing showed on monitors, et cetera, et cetera.
Was this breakdown a turning point for you?
Well, it was the start of it, yes. I got some exceptionally good help, and initially we started dealing with the because at that stage I hadn't spoken to anyone professionally about the memory recall. So I got some very good help dealing with that to start with. But during the course of dealing with that, they diagnosed that I had depression. So they started feeding me on antidepressants.
But you didn't have depression.
But I didn't have depression. That's the problem, of course, with bipolar. It takes about 10 years normally to diagnose bipolar in Australia, because people come in when they're depressed. But when you're as high as a kite, you don't go into the doctor and say,
it's great.
Hey, I feel fantastic.
Yeah, this is a problem.
Please fix me.
I just got 4 days' work done in two.
Yes, that's right.
I've got a problem, yeah. So did that mean if you were misdiagnosed, if that's the word for it, with depression, did that mean you were given the wrong medication?
Well, the problem is, because I'm a rapid cycler, or ultra-rapid cycler, with ultra-rapid cycling bipolar, if you give people heavier and heavier antidepressants, which was what happening because I wasn't getting better, it actually locks them into depression. So it has the reverse effect. So during that year, as they were trying to work out what was wrong with me, I had 4 suicide attempts. Each one accompanied with, you know, little visits to facilities.
Were you rescued each time, or did you pull yourself back?
Each time something strange. I must be just crap at doing it, I think, but each time I was pulled back by strange and bizarre circumstances. From doing various things, and I won't talk about the different attempts, because it's not a good thing to actually talk about how, but bad enough that you try it, I guess.
Did you feel you were living at the mercy of these memories?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Had this man, Hairy Arms, become like, I don't know, the gigantic monster of the year in your mind, a kind of a monster that was transfigured beyond human proportions?
Well, certainly I was terrified of. I mean, I got to the point where, still happens. Coming here to your studio, I made sure that to go to the toilet, I made sure I used the one here. So I wasn't so confident about being in public. Now, I get over that by once I get used to a place, then there's no dramas, but it's still a fear. I still have that fear. And it's something I've instilled, you know, in my kids even, which is, I don't know, probably a bad thing rather than a good one. But
given that you had a name and an identity for him, were you ever wanting to confront him?
A lot of people said I should have, but to be honest, I was just still too frightened. And then he died about, well, I think 18 months. I'm not exact on that, but he died after I'd found out who he was. So.
By the sound of things, well, I'm just guessing it, perhaps you weren't his only victim.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's something that plagues me, but I'm not sure there's a lot I could have done about it, but, There's a sense that you should stand up immediately, but I know the guy's got family, and I don't see why they should be, you know, cast with what he's done.
What did you do with the knowledge then?
Well, what I've done with the knowledge is, I hope, is to be more helpful to others, but essentially to get rid of that demon that had been behind me and pushing me all those years.
How did you do that?
Well, through a combination of talking it through and talking what through it happened, and understanding it wasn't my fault. For a long time, I thought it was my fault because of the circumstances of, you know, that I've been standing there in the toilet with.
Can you know it's not your fault and still feel it's your fault?
Not anymore, no. No, I'm past that.
Was there a time when you did do that, where you can know with absolute certainty it's not your fault and still feel it's somehow your fault?
Because the problem is that the start of it isn't. It's head knowledge. It's what I call head knowledge, not gut knowledge. And until it becomes something that you really accept and understand, that becomes part of your whole person of knowing that's how it is, you can't beat it until then.
Given that you weren't able to get this wretched man into a room and address him, were you able to address him anyway without getting him into a room?
Yeah, the final thing that we did was, and others may be familiar with this technique, well, I wrote him a letter. And then I came into my psychologist, and we imagined that he was sitting in a chair, And then I read the letter to him and then explained to him the effect that it had on my life.
Were you shouting when you read that letter?
No, I didn't feel the need for shouting or violence or...
Were you in control when you read that letter?
I think I had to be, yes. I, as far as I was concerned, it was very important for me to be in control because even though he was imaginary, he wasn't going to see this. I hope you can cope with this, everyone, but even though he was imaginary, he wasn't going to get the better of me by having me shake and quail in front of him.
That's why I asked the question. I'm really conscious of the power issue here because rape is an act of power. Mm. That's what we're told anyway.
Well, he wasn't taking any more power from me or he had. I'm afraid I was going to stay in control.
And at the end of you reading that letter, what then?
We burnt it and buried it, and then I really have over a space of days only, I found that the burden was lifted. So,
does doing something like that require an act of forgiveness from
Certainly.
You?
And that was at the key of it. I may not be popular to say this, but I'm a Christian, and as a result of that, I believe very strongly in the power of forgiveness. Now, I'm not a Christian of the church. I have a very strong faith and belief and a relationship with God directly. I think the church gets in the way of that a bit. But so forgiving him was the way I was going to become free. And it was in the end, the letter was all about that. I had actually said to the psychologist, what if I was to forgive him? He said, well, forgiveness, it's an interesting concept, religious, but it still works. So that was sort of behind why we did the letter. So,
does that act of forgiveness give you power back?
Freedom. Not power, freedom. There's a difference. I don't want to have power over him. I just want to be free of him.
Power over that monster in your mind that he represents?
Free.
And did you feel better after that?
Yeah, it took fully probably a year or so, but yeah. And within days, I felt better. And significantly, I've only had the dream once since under a period of extreme provocation.
Were you able to get a proper diagnosis after that?
Well, that was probably the next crucial thing that happened because by the time I'd been in therapy for about 14 months... And I still wasn't getting better and still on all these antidepressants. And I think Sue sensed that I might be building up to another suicide attempt. This was early stage of the internet. So she said, well, I want you to go downtown today and I want you to buy an internet connection, a computer, and I want you to sit there because you're the only one smart enough to work out what's going on. So she appealed to the last little bit of ego I had. I worked away for about 4 to 5 weeks. And every single checklist I could find, and again, the information available then is very different from what's available now. There was no Black Dog Institute or Beyond Blue or anything of that sort of nature. And I ended up filling in about 6 pages of checklists and every single box was ticked. And it was a Friday afternoon, she came in from work and I said, you better read this. So she went off to another room and read it. She came in. And I stood up, she gave me a big hug, and she said, you poor bastard. And so from there it was back to the doctor, the psychologist, the psychiatrist, and a long, long appointment with the psychiatrist. And he said, yeah, it's definitely bipolar. So
you made the diagnosis and got the doctors to concur with it.
Well,
yeah, well, not got them to, but they, presented it to them in a
they,
way.
They, in the end, made the diagnosis. But, yeah, I mean, I could... What I was able to bring to the table was my knowledge of me and the history of me and the things I was doing, and the checklist helped in that. I couldn't diagnose it, obviously. That had to happen from them. But
did that thing mean you could be given proper medication for it?
Yeah, well, see, the antidepressants were gradually removed. I was put on lithium to start with. That's the gold standard of bipolar medication, which takes care of the ups. And then from there, things just... It took, I suppose, about another 2 years, and then by then I was starting to manage things. And
that's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we only actually got all the medication sorted about a year ago. I was 11 years getting all the medication right, getting an absolute mix, the mix right. So, well, we had other nice little things happening there, like my wife announced she was leaving because I still had this white heat anger that comes with bipolar, and she'd been through an awful lot. And so in the end... we had to sort those issues through, which we have, and she's managed to hang in there.
It seems to me like, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist by any means, but it seems like a really complicated disorder insofar as the downsides we're hearing about them now, and they're very, very real. But then they have these kind of blazing superpower advantages at times in your life too, don't they? So it's a blessing curse mixed all into one. Is that how you see it?
It is, but it's a, I call it my gift because, you know, a study that was done says that about 30% of all writers since the Gutenberg Press exhibit signs of bipolar or were diagnosed with bipolar. So it tends to be, they call sometimes a creative illness actually. But they've done several studies now in both the States and I think here in Australia as well, where the end point of the study is to say to people with bipolar, there's a green button and a red button. The green button, you keep it. The red button, it goes away. More than 90% green button.
Well, because if you want the red button, you want to be another person, don't you? Is that right? I mean, because green button is the button of self-acceptance, surely, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's what it really means. That's what it really means. You're accepting who you are and you can and who you want to be.
So you've really been going through this very long and incredibly painful process of integration, really, of that moment of disintegration where, as a kid, a 16-year-old, you standing on a ledge of an overpass at a shopping centre about to jump off it.
For a reason I didn't understand that I do now. So,
so is that how you see it, is this long process of collecting these scattered parts of yourself and accepting them and seeing them as the part of the larger picture of yourself?
I don't see them as parts anymore, to be honest. I just see me as me, and they're things that have happened. And they're all things that have shaped the me I am now. I mean, I'm not teaching anymore, which is a real shame. I love teaching, but I'm doing other things. You know, I'm doing other things that I hope are useful, that I couldn't do without those experiences.
What are those other things?
One of the things, I'm working as a community presenter for the Black Dog Institute, so I go into communities and I present talks from small groups up to large groups about mood disorders, what they are, what they look like, how you can help someone, where you can get help. And part of that is to, they've asked me, is to put my input into their presentation so that it becomes very real to the listener, that they're actually, to the person who's there, they're actually talking and listening to someone who's been through these things. My writing has, it's a lot more even than it ever was. I mean, I used to write when I was manic, and I've still got some of the stuff from when I was at Teachers College, and my God, I could never use it in a million years. It's highly inventive, highly brilliant rubbish. Whereas now I still have lots of ideas, and I'm producing now more and better than I ever have.
How do you manage the ups and downs now, insofar as they're still there after the medication?
Sure. Well, and the key issue for me is that I could take more medication and they wouldn't be there altogether, but then I don't want to be like everybody else. So I take them so to the level that I can cope. So, yes, I still do have highs, but they're nothing like I used to have, but I still revel in the days when I feel, you know, when reds look redder and blues look bluer and greens look greener. I mean, you really do notice stuff that people miss. I know, sorry to everyone who doesn't have the opportunity, but you really do. And on the down days, my wife and I developed this thing called Rescue My Day, and on the worst of those days, to rescue my day might only mean getting out to the letterbox, but at least I got out to the letterbox. You know, it hasn't beaten me. Even if you do one small thing, I did it.
It's been great speaking with you, Peter. Amazing speaking with you, in fact. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Mental health
is important
to all of us.
In October,
ABC brings you
Mental As,
a week of shows
and events
to get people talking about mental health.
With mental illness
affecting nearly half the population,
don't be afraid to talk about it.
Seek help from friends,
family,
or health professionals.
And please, give generously
during Mental Health Week.
Talk.
Give.
Seek.
Mental As.
All this week
on ABC Television, radio and online.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler.
For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.